Next case is 06-1247, Mark A. McLeod, Guardian versus Mount Sinai Medical Center. Mr. Beam here. Ms. Keys Walker, you may begin.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Irene Keys Walker. I represent Mount Sinai Hospital, which is the hospital where Dr. Jordan ordered the cesarean section to take place in 1987 in this case. With me, Mr. Mark Herman, who represents the late Dr. Jordan and the Northeast Ohio Health Services. We'll be splitting our time. I'll be sitting down at the end of 6 minutes. Your Honor, following up on the last case that you had, the key issue in this case as well is the standard of review. Indeed, I don't know that I've ever seen a case where the importance of the standard of appellate review is more critical. In this case, it was not a manifest weight of the evidence. And by the way, Your Honor, Rohde versus Farmer is a case where you see the discussion of the sufficiency of the evidence and the manifest weight discussed interchangeably. In this case, that was the manifest weight of the evidence was the standard applied by the appellate court, and it was applied incorrectly by giving a presumption of correctness to the jury verdict. In your constitutional provision that you heard in the last argument, that discusses when a judgment results from a jury verdict. In this case, we had no judgment. You get a judgment either because there was no post-trial challenge to a verdict, or you get a judgment because there was a post-trial challenge and it was rejected. Here, there was no judgment because a court determined that the jury never got a shot at deciding this case on the facts because the evidence was tainted. It was tainted by trial court error. It was tainted by attorney misconduct. And as a result of that taint, there was no judgment because there was no fair trial.
Who tried the case?
The attorneys themselves?
No, the judge.
This was Judge Lothar,
okay.
Your Honor.
A nice man. I've known him a long time.
Thank you.
And he indicates that he made an incorrect ruling on the economist's testimony because of the report. But he also goes on at length to say, well, I've looked at all of these. This just has to be passion and prejudice because how could it be that large a verdict? Now, I find that somewhat troubling, particularly when he gets to the non-economic, his discussion there.
And I think that part of that reason, Your Honor, is because you have to recognize in this particular case how that error that he made actually translated into not only inducing an excessive verdict of economic damages, but also non-economic damages and liability. You have to remember in this case, you have a situation where you get $14.3 million coming in for the first time, double or treble what the expert reports had been. You have defense counsel who did not retain any economic experts based on their reliance on the discovery and the reports that had been submitted. Then you go into closing argument, and Mr. Grodel gets up in his closing argument and suggests to the jury that a $6 million verdict will be fair if they were to find liability, because that was well within the upper range of the expert reports before the new improper evidence. And then counsel gets up on rebuttal and says, listen to these counsel, it's all a game to them. It's all about money. They just want to save money. The whole impression was you can't trust these counsel. You can't trust what they say. It's all a game, and you can't trust their case.
Isn't that fair commentary? And isn't it up to the judge to rein it in when it goes over the top?
It is, Your Honor, and I think Judge Lothar recognized that. As they said in the Plass case, he gave a too long deferred new trial in this case. There were many times during the trial where
My question is, couldn't this all be corrected by a an order of a remitter or new trial?
I don't believe it can, Your Honor, because the remitter itself has to depend on having evidence that is itself competent and untainted.
But you just said the defendants opted not to put in economic damages, relying on the reports. So couldn't you look at the reports that weren't testified, you know, that were furnished, what it was, $4 to $6 million in the report? And that apparently was within the ballpark in the view of the defendants.
And I understand the difficulty.
So why couldn't a court look to that number and say, look, that's the number the defendants relied on. They weren't refuting it. So for economic damages, this is the number, or you try it again.
And certainly Judge Lothar was given that option, Your Honor, and looked at it. But what he also did was he read the entire 2,400-page transcript and determined that all of the factors, this is not simply a question of one piece of evidence coming in that was improper, but of numerous errors, both on the part of the court and on the part of counsel, made in a 6-2 jury verdict that was split on liability. Well, and
most highly contested, or a lot of highly contested cases are 6-2. There's not much unusual about that. It seems troubling to me that you have a long trial, a long wait for a trial, obviously, that that some opportunity to accept a reduced verdict versus a new trial isn't afforded, particularly when the judge is reading the transcript and saying, oh, I didn't do a very good job of trying this case.
And before I sit down, Your Honor, I would only say that that would simply reward the deliberate misconduct of counsel in this case.
Thank you, Ms. Keyes-Walker. Mr. Herman.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, I'll reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. I'm Mark Herman, here on behalf of Appellants Ronald Jordan, M.D., and Northeast Ohio Neighborhood Health Services. The court may know Northeast Ohio Neighborhood Health Services by its former name, the Huff Norwood Clinics. Those clinics were created to provide medical services in areas where poverty is pervasive and health resources are scarce. Because this verdict threatens the very existence of those clinics, I'm joined here today by the CEO and vice chair of the board of the organization, Messrs. Willie Austin and Matt Fitzsimmons. I'd like to highlight, before I even begin, just how difficult it is to explain in the 6 minutes that I'm going to take pervasive misconduct that occurred throughout the course of a 3-week trial. That is, all I can do is talk about discrete incidents here and there in this courtroom to give you a couple of examples. Judge Karpinski took a full 45 pages in dissent to try to give the flavor of what was going on across this 3-week trial. In fact, that's one reason why this court defers to the trial judge who actually tried the case. That is, he lived it, he felt it, and I have very little power here today either to describe enough incidents to give you a sense of what happened or to help you pull from a cold record the actual conduct that occurred at trial. Please do also remember that it is undisputed for purposes of this appeal that the economic damages that the jury awarded were excessive. That is, the trial judge so held, the Court of Appeals unanimously affirmed, the plaintiff has not appealed. The economic damages.
Aren't we really here on the review of the trial court's order granting a new trial or judgment notwithstanding the verdict?
New trial.
Right?
Yes.
Okay, so what is the standard that should be applied in reviewing that order as opposed to the trial jury verdict?
Well, that's Rohde against Farmer, Your Honor. That says that you defer not to what the jury did. You defer instead to the new trial order because the judge is operating as a finder of fact when he grants a new trial. The judge is not granting judgment notwithstanding the verdict.
And shouldn't we be looking at Civil Rule 59A2? Or A4 in this case.
A2 and A4 are the ones at issue, and all deference is owed to the new trial order, the deference is not owed to the jury verdict because the judge is reweighing facts and is concluding that there has to be a new trial.
And isn't that within the discretion of the trial court?
It is absolutely a discretionary decision, Your Honor. And given a three-week trial and a judge who lived it and the overwhelming evidence of trial court misconduct in both the new trial order itself and in the 45-page dissent, obviously there's plenty to affirm a discretionary decision that there has to be a do-over in this sort of situation.
So is there competent, credible evidence to support the court's order awarding a new trial?
Your Honor, it's not a close call. I mean, the whole issue at trial, obviously Walter Hollins was born with terrible issues, but...
That really isn't before us, though, is it? Aren't we just looking at what the trial court did and whether or not there's evidence to support the order in conformity with Civil Rule 59?
Absolutely.
We're looking at a legal issue here concerning the ability of a trial court to order a new trial and whether or not there was or wasn't an abuse of discretion in doing so. And we determine that from the evidence that supports the court's order one way or the other.
And among other evidence, what you said is absolutely right, and among other evidence, there was evidence at trial that the baby's joints were fused, which occurs during the course of long-term chronic oxygen deprivation through the course of the pregnancy, not as a result of a 90-minute delay at the time of pregnancy. There was evidence of a short umbilical cord, which occurs as a result of long-term oxygen deprivation throughout the course of the pregnancy, not as a result of being oxygen-starved for 90 minutes at an end. There was evidence that the baby's head was terribly small, which occurs chronically over time, not as a result of a 90-minute delay at the end. So is there evidence to support the idea that this was not due to malpractice at the end, but rather was chronic oxygen deprivation throughout the pregnancy? Overwhelming evidence of that, very little evidence going the other way. That's probably one reason Judge Lawther chose to order a new trial.
But his focus is all on his reasons are basically related to the damages.
He does both, Your Honor. It is absolutely true that he talks about the damages, but then he goes on to give several examples in his new trial order of the misconduct of counsel, which causes passion and prejudice, which results both in an excessive damage award and in a tainted liability verdict. If the jury is inflamed by passion and prejudice, that affects both the damages and the liability verdict itself, which is why you can't pull the two apart here.
Ms. Keyes Walker told us why remittitor is not sufficient remedy in this case. What would you add to what she said? Anything?
Once you find that there is sufficient evidence to suggest passion and prejudice, there has to be a new trial. Because once the jury is inflamed by passion and prejudice, a new trial is all you can do because the passion and prejudice affects liability as well as damages.
I thought an awful lot of the case discussion of passion and prejudice is focused on the issue of damages.
It is certainly true that some of that law goes that way, but there are other cases that squarely hold that it affects both.
That's what remittitor is for, is to correct that.
Remittitor is for damages, but new trials are for passion and prejudice that infect the liability phase as well, Your Honor. Your Honor, it might be easier to forgive what happened at this trial, but for the words of the Michigan Supreme Court in another case involving this very trial counsel.
Is that in the record?
We're citing a Michigan Supreme Court case, Your Honor, which held that, quote, overreaching prejudice-baiting rhetoric appears to be a calculated routine feature of counsel's trial strategy. So this is not the first time it happened. It's not a rookie lawyer trying his first case and accidentally stepping over the line. Judge Lawther was well within his discretion to order a new trial.
Thank you, Mr. Herman. Mr. Beam.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, my name is Jack Beam, and I represent the plaintiff appellee in this case. 9 years ago, this case was filed in Cleveland. 3 years ago tomorrow, the jury returned a verdict in favor of the plaintiff after a five-week trial. The evidence was competent, and the evidence was credible. To go to what Justice Pfeiffer's pointed out, the trial judge did not like the damage award. He says it explicitly in his opinion. Contrary to what, with all due respect, Justice O'Donnell said, you have to look at the judge's opinion for why he found that this should be, why there should be a new trial.
Would you agree the standard is, Mr. Beam, that we should determine whether or not the order of the trial court is supported by competent, credible evidence?
I would agree that that's probably the standard, Your Honor, but I think you need to also look that to the rule that, that if the trial judge's opinion reflects an unconscionable attitude, that you have to ignore that trial judge's opinion, and you have to find that there was an abuse of discretion. Now, you may say, Mr. Beam, unconscionable attitude. This is a very nice man who some of you in the court know well. But I submit to this court, as human beings, albeit judges, that when you look at this man, now a man, he started out as a baby, and you write in your opinion after a five-week trial that he has no pain and suffering. And that's a quote from Judge Lawther's opinion. If you can look at this man and say he experiences no pain and suffering, and you all know pain and suffering includes loss of enjoyment of life and disfigurement. If you as jurists can look at this man and conclude that, then I think you probably do agree with Judge Lawther that, that this is too much money. But if anyone can look at him...
Well, we're really not looking at that, are we?
Well, I think one of the, well, at least one of the justices is, with all due respect. And if you look at Judge Lawther's opinion, what does he say? He said $3 million would be fine. When he ordered us after the trial to come to a meeting at Nuremberg Pleven and said, I want to tell both sides how I'm going to rule, and I submit to you that's a violation of Canon 3 for a judge.
Is that all in the record?
That's in the appendix, yes, Canon 3, and it's the letter of his letter of June telling us that he's going to tell each side how he's going to decide, and he wants us to come to a hearing or a mediation after the verdict. I think you find begin to see a pattern of misconduct there. When
counsel, why is that not a pattern of a judge trying to remedy a situation that he may have felt partially responsible for in the conduct of the trial and trying to do the right thing? I really don't know that we're here to listen to you disparage the trial judge.
Well, and Your Honor, I think that's a good point because But if you look at the opinion, what does he hold up? He said there was an irregularity in the proceeding. You'll recall that from his opinion. What was the irregularity in the proceeding? It was an ex-party meeting with the judge and the defense counsel and the jury during deliberation. Now, at some point, do we look at his opinion? And I think the court has to look closely at the opinion. He held up an irregularity in the proceeding, which was caused by an ex-party communication between the defense and himself and the jury, unbeknownst to us until after the verdict. He holds that up as a reason to take away a verdict from the plaintiff. At some point, we need to look with logic and reason at his opinion without regard to our personal feelings about the judge. And I mean that with all due respect to you and to him, Your Honor. The fact of the matter is, if you can look at this man and say he has no pain and suffering, then I think you have to say that Ohio State does not wear scarlet and gray. Because that is an unconscionable attitude for a jurist to have. That one fact alone.
That's not quite an accurate quote, sir. There's no evidence that Walter suffers regular, continuous pain.
Right.
That you're kind of stretching his statement to.
Well, but Your Honor, you know that the instruction for pain and suffering includes not just pain; it also includes disfigurement.
And he acknowledges he has all of that.
Right.
He goes on at great length acknowledging all of that. I don't see that as being a sufficient basis for us finding that his opinion was not based on competent, credible evidence.
Well, the jury found, and we, you know, it was a jury trial, and the jury concluded that there was competent and credible evidence that this this child had.
Could you address one of the key issues that focuses in both the dissent and the trial court's opinion? The conduct of the attorney that resulted in passion and prejudice. Your You've not addressed that at all, and that seems to figure very large in his opinion. Would you address that?
Yes, yes, Your Honor. Best example of that is for when Judge Karpinski talks about the fact that he can't cross-examine nurses and doctors about fact of fetal distress and emergency. This is a situation where that the mother was prepped and shaved, and it wasn't until 2 hours later that an emergency C-section was performed. 2 hours to perform a C-section. Now, as the court may know, a good surgeon can do a crash C-section in less than 10 minutes. There was fetal distress. There was a flat line on the monitor, and that's you'll find in the record. There was a flat line on the monitor.
Is that how you would have tried a case? The questions he asked, the disparaging of witnesses. I mean, I read the statements that the attorney himself used, not anybody else. The attorney used. And I could tell you I would never, ever have allowed those statements in my court when I was a trial judge.
Could you give me a specific example, Your Honor?
Well, I can look them up again. But go ahead with your argument.
Well, one of the things he did, I think, that the trial judge rightfully was offended about was that the trial judge would tell him would sustain an objection. And the attorney would come back with the same question or one that was just a little bit different. I mean, he was defying the trial judge. Time after time, if Judge Karpinski's opinion is correct, I mean, that alone is disrespectful to the process, not just to the judge, but to the process. We have rules by which trials are supposed to be conducted. And it seems to me he violated, I mean, you don't have to be a lawyer to read the transcript and realize he violated a number of the rules of just the way in which we conduct a fact-finding mission.
Well, Chief Justice, keeping in mind that the cases that have come before this court in the past, where the door has been opened, where the attacks have been made, the courts are pretty careful to point out where there's there was repeated attacks, as was pointed out in the brief by the defense in the opening statement, calling Mr. Feiger all sorts of names, talking about his misstatements and mischaracterizations of the record, and that was the opening salvo. Just like this thing about the Bible. Well, who opened the door on that? The defense opened the door on talking about that. This what happened to Walter Hollins was God's will. And so at that point, the door was open. And Your Honor knows that the recent capital case where that was an issue. And the court pointed out, rightly so, that when the door has been opened like that, it was fair for the prosecution to come back with references.
Counsel, I want to come at this a slightly different way. Ms. Keyes Walker's description of some of the decisions of defense counsel are a bit eye-opening, and so what I haven't attempted to try and read this record, and maybe that'll be my duty, maybe it won't, but I'm guessing when one reads the record, you'll find some unorthodox choices by defense counsel and maybe some, when you have a lawyer who comes across as hot as Feiger,
yes, sir.
Is that the way you pronounce his name, does frequently defense counsel rises to the occasion and lively sparring goes on, and to quell that, the judge has to take control. I think the difficult question to me is, because I guess in looking this, a remitter would seem to be in order, or a new trial. But the difficult question is, did the hot way that Feiger tries a case have an impact, an improper impact on the determination of liability? If it did, then remitter would be out the door.
On that note, Your Honor, I'd like to point the court to the interrogatory answer of the jury. And I don't want to take up my time here reading it, but if the court could look at that, I think you would find it to be very reasoned and not full of any passion, not full of any prejudice. Again, this is a case which defense concedes. They never put on any evidence of economic damage. They knew for years that they were dealing with a spastic quadriplegic. They knew for years they had the life care plan of George Cyphers, the first draft of one since 2000. And they, in effect, stipulated to $12.6 million in damages, either stipulated or didn't object. Now, that's not even the Court of Appeals points that out. And they never appeal liability. So to have a remitter would seem to be the logical choice if, in fact, this court thinks that it's a...
When you say they stipulated to 12.6, that's economic and non-economic?
That's economic. That's economic damages. In Dr. Cypher's report was about $9 million, and then they did not object to part of Rosen's testimony, which takes it up to 12.6. So there was $12.6 million of economic damages that were never challenged. I mean, they stipulated to that in the proceeding, and they never
by stipulated you mean they didn't challenge?
Well, yeah, no, they actually admitted his life care plan was admitted in evidence, and at that point the jury could have totaled up. Without any economist or anything, they could have just ignored, you know, they have a jury, can't ignore expert testimony.
Yeah.
They could have totaled up $9 million in the economic report alone. Now, you know, we've been 9 years at this litigation. At some point, there should be some finality. I think
you were referring to when I asked you about whether or not the hot way the Figer tries a case infected it to the point that it could have tipped the scales in favor of liability improperly. You referred to a jury's answer to an interrogatory.
Right.
And what is that?
The jury said, this is what the jury said in answering their verdict. Dr. Jordan saw a potential for neurological damage. He failed to monitor the fetus closely. And the preponderance of the evidence is that damage occurred during the delay. Dr. Jordan did not have the fetal monitor on. He was unable to demonstrate that the delay was harmless. That's what they said about Dr. Jordan. Mount Sinai did not expedite an urgent C-section and did not properly monitor the fetus during a critical time. As a result of the delay, neurological damage occurred. I submit to your honors that that's not passion, that's not prejudice. These are lay people speaking. That's a fairly concise and fair reading of the evidence. I mean, if we have a deference for jury trials as opposed to the opinion of one individual, the judge, I think we have to find that the jury verdict gets some preference in America, at least, and hopefully the court could see fit after 9 years of litigation. If the damages are too much according to Ohio sensibilities, at that point, couldn't we have a remitter?
But Mr. B, my review here isn't as to whether the verdict is supported by competent, credible evidence. We're supposed to be looking at the trial court's order granting a new trial to see if that is supported by competent, credible evidence, which involves, as Justice Pfeiffer points out, the alleged misconduct of trial counsel and whether or not the verdict was influenced by passion or prejudice arising in this trial.
Understandable.
Isn't that the narrow focus of our review on this appeal?
Right, but
don't you
so
agree
narrow.
that's all we're looking at?
Yes, but narrow with, but please read the opinion of the judge with reference to.
Oh, trust me, we'll read everything here.
With reference to the condition of this child, and you have to say it's an unconscionable attitude for a judge to say and that there's no continuing pain and suffering. That's an unconscionable position, I think that's fair to say. You can't look at a child that will never walk and never talk. You can't. Can you look at a human being and say that's not continuing pain and suffering? Maybe you can. I can't. But that's
well, that the issue though isn't before us right at the moment because all we're really looking at is what the Court of Appeals judgment was in connection with the review of the trial court ordering a new trial. And our review is really far more narrow than you're arguing to us. I mean, were the case before us, then I agree that we'd have to look at the entire the entity of the argument you're presenting to us. But
well,
really, that isn't here, is it?
I respectfully disagree, because I think you have to. I think you framed the issue, Your Honor. But I think the fact of the matter is, when you look at the opinion, and you do have a right to say, is this opinion unconscionable when he says this child has no continuing pain and suffering? Is it unconscionable when they've got $12.6 million in evidence? And let me just leave one thought on the misconduct, because I still haven't had any specifics yet that I can point to. I'm shooting at a moving target about misconduct. This is what our friends at the Life Legal Defense Foundation said. These are folks who don't think it's improper to argue for the rights of an unborn child. While appellant Mount Sinai contends that the transcript is littered with objections throughout the proceeding, it fails to cite any objection raised at the time of the alleged misconduct or to explain why none were raised at those times. This is a case where there's a paucity, to say the least, of objections. And that is something I think the court, with all due respect, has to be mindful of, too. They didn't object to hardly any of the issues. I won't say they didn't object to anything, but they didn't object to hardly any of the issues at all. Now, this court's had that before them. And seen that at a trial court, and then they come here, and objections are not something that rise to their feet at the appellate process. I do know that much. I ask for the court's consideration of to affirm the verdict, without regard to any predispositions. I must respectfully submit that even with Justice O'Donnell's an analysis, that when you look at the opinion, you cannot, in your hearts and as a matter of law, say that this child did not have continuing pain and suffering. And once you reach that conclusion, you're entitled to say that the trial judge showed an unconscionable attitude. A remitter would finally end 9 years of litigation. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Beam. Ms. Keyes-Walker, you've saved just a little more than a minute of your time.
Counsel has reminded me that Book versus Erskine is the Ohio Supreme Court case indicating that remittiture is not the proper remedy when there's passion and prejudice. In that case, it doesn't go to damages. You require a new trial. I must say that objections preservation of the record is not at issue in this case, because what we have is a trial judge who's been invested with the obligation to decide if a manifest injustice took place and exercise that discretion and granted a new trial. There was no need to cross appeal on liability. We've been given the only thing we ask, a fair trial, an opportunity to present untainted evidence to the jury. And Justice Pfeiffer, I'd like to give just one other example of why remittiture can't work in this case. We had a spoliation claim that was directed out for absolutely no evidence at the end of plaintiff's case. And yet, in closing argument, plaintiff called a cover-up, accused the defendants of altering and hiding records, accused witnesses of prevaricating, all of those attacks, which he said is based on missing records.
Let me ask you to respond to his summarization of a general lack of active objection to these things as they occurred, because I've not in this case, but in another big verdict case, I had occasion to go through the record, and my summary of that would be defense counsel slept through a lot of things, and then wanted us to unring the bell afterwards. So, what will we find in that regard?
Well, Your Honor, my favorite response to that was by the California court in Love versus Wolf, which we cite in our reply brief, that says we'd have a little more sympathy on the objection if we didn't feel like defense counsel was pairing as best they could, mostly left to their own devices because the court didn't intervene. Defense counsel objected five times in opening statement. Four of those were overruled, including an objection to an entirely new cause of action that had never been introduced before. Objection overruled. What happened was time after time again, they would object, the court would sustain, and the question would come back anyway. Or they would object, it would be overruled. So all they were doing was bringing more and more attention to the jury and giving Mr. Feiger an opportunity to simply repeat his improper evidence. A lot of these things are not evident in the record because this is one of those records that you would have had to repeat 2,400s of transcript. The trial judge read that transcript. Judge Karpinski read that transcript.
Would you acknowledge that as we analyze the narrow question as Justice O'Donnell has articulated it, there's some troubling things in Judge Lather's opinion as well?
No, Your Honor.
You wouldn't?
I think that Judge Lather tried to summarize what happened in that 2,400-page transcript as best he could, and quite frankly, I don't have the ability to excerpt and twist, and I know that's a statement they don't like, statements as well as he can, but as Judge Stratton indicated, that's what they're doing. Judge Lather was very frustrated, I believe, because he had not intervened more quickly, and therefore a lot of his opinion goes to the improper way of making objections and defiance of the court. But what he said was that his manipulation, improper manipulation and misconduct led him to a totally unjustified verdict. And that is absolutely true. Justice Karpinski expanded on it in 45 pages. I could expand on it in 75 pages. But the only way that a court can review a judgment like that, if they're thinking of reversing, is to read the transcript. It's not what the judge says in one sentence or one phrase, but it's whether error occurred, whether it tainted the evidence, and whether the judge that has been given the duty to ensure that justice occurs in his court finds that it hasn't been because of misconduct of counsel and error of the trial court. There is no greater threat to the jury system than to ignore that finding of a trial judge.
Thank you, Ms. Keyes-Walker. The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. We'll take a brief recess.
All rise.